This is a Glass Box Media Podcast.
And welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers, and those difficult moments along the way. I'm Giles Pettifips, and in his rainbow room, it's Jim Daly. And we're both wearing pink sweatshirts. You can't, obviously, the listeners can't see that, but we are wearing pink.
Yeah, love. I don't know if I have the complexion for pink, but I do like wearing pink. So I just
like pink,
it.
And I'm the same. I'm quite pale-skinned. I'm never sure if I have the right look or vibe, but I like do you like pink?
I do. It's a strong color. So I'm happy with it, and I've got a really comfy pink sweatshirt on that I really like wearing, so.
Yeah, same.
It won't be in the social image for this because it's in black and white. Maybe, yeah. I make this one color,
maybe you should, so that people can see the full pink.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, how are you doing?
We're like the Pink Panthers. What was the question?
How's your week been?
It's been all right, man. Yeah, it's been okay. How about yours?
Yeah, not too bad, actually. I don't feel like I've done much this week, but, the sun is shining, which is always nice. I'm going to try and get out this afternoon. Otherwise, not too bad. Very excited about this week's guest.
Oh, so excited, man. What a treat it was.
Yeah, she's an absolute legend. We had one of the easiest guests we've had, yeah. I think, in terms of chat. Just absolutely brilliant. And what I would say, a very inspirational person who has packed in. Oh my gosh, she's done so much.
Yeah, honestly, so much stuff. And obviously a consummate professional,
yeah,
doing kind of what we don't do very well, which is interviewing people.
Yeah, but it was weird for her, we talked at the start, to be the interviewee,
yes,
rather than the interviewer this week. Although I'd say she was really good at it.
Yeah.
She said, oh, I'll try and deflect from questions and stuff. I thought she was fantastic.
Well, she may have deflected.
If she did, then I didn't
She did it very skillfully. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're not looking to kind of catch anyone out.
No, we just want to have like fun chats and interesting chats. And this was definitely one of those. Should say who it is, really, shouldn't we?
We probably should.
It's Louise Minchin. It's the wonderful Louise Minchin, journalist, adventurer, I think you can say as well.
And
athlete.
Athlete and writer.
And writer. There you go. Does a bit of everything. So she talked to us. We actually got straight into it, didn't we? Talking about sort of like, I think it's the earliest we got to blank moments, literal blank moments on screen. Which is fantastic. And then she goes on to talk about her fabulous new book, Fearless, which is coming out, Adventures of Extraordinary Women, and all the so many adventures she got into there. So yeah, an absolutely fascinating chat with Louise, which I know we say this every week, but we could have done more. And I think there'll be a part two at some point with her, because we could have chatted forever.
Well, there was lots of secret stuff she wouldn't tell us about. So she was a bit evasive on some things. But yes, absolutely. So good. The book is brilliant. I highly recommend it. It's out on May the 25th. It's so many incredible women doing incredible adventures. You know, oh God, there's like cave, wild caving. And there's like
free diving.
I think she did 1,200 kilometers across Argentina. So all these amazing, amazing adventures that she's been on. And obviously she did these things herself. It wasn't just talking about these women doing these things. She was actually doing them herself and experiencing them. So, I mean, that's amazing in itself, that she's got to do all these incredible things. And then obviously documented it in the book.
I don't know if I would do any of them. I don't. No, it sounds fascinating. That. To hear about. I don't know if I would have the balls to do any of
the cycling one. I might be, because I do a bit of cycling, but I wouldn't do caving.
Far?
I mean, caving is I'd shit myself, I think. And no one wants that in a cave.
Not in a cave.
No, that floating around.
No one could go in that cave after you. You'd ruin that cave for everyone.
I would have literally soiled it.
Terrible. Anyway.
I suppose if it was an discovered cave, it could be the first and last time someone's done that in there.
It would remain uncovered, undiscovered.
Yeah. People are like, oh, it's a bit stenchy in there. Don't go in there.
And give it 15 minutes. Anyway,
we've lowered the
worst promo that your book will get on this.
Sorry. No, it's I mean, honestly, the book is fantastic. I highly, highly recommend it. Brilliantly written as well. And we talked to Louise about her process and how she does her writing. And I know she sort of enjoyed talking about that stuff, as you know, as fellow writers, it's always fun to talk about that thing, those things. And honestly, some of the women in the book is just so amazing. It's just incredible. So yeah, definitely check out the book.
Really, yeah. There's a link below the show notes now to get a copy of it, out on May 25th, which might be soon. It might have happened depending on when you're listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
I think we should get into it.
We really should.
Yeah, let's do it, because we've teased it enough. This is the fantastic Louise Minchin on the Blank Podcast.
Well, Louise Minchin, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's so lovely to see you. It's been great to get this done and have you on us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. And I've listened to your podcast and I feel, what do I feel? I feel that you have some very honest conversations with people. So I feel slightly, because I don't normally answer questions, nervous.
Oh, really? Okay, well, we won't, we're not...
No, you're not.
This isn't going to be like Emily Maitlis or anything.
It's
like...
not the Today programme.
Yeah.
In a good way.
Yeah.
Yeah. We like the guests kind of, if we were doing like the PR spoof, like the guests drive it. If that
makes
sense.
Okay. Yeah.
Where are we going to go today then?
Yeah. So we're going to go.
To you.
Yeah. We're going to go where you want it to go. So, you know.
There you go. Pressure.
Is it weird? Okay. I will like open with a kind of serious question. Yeah. Is it weird then to be answering questions when you're so used to asking them?
Yeah, it's really strange. And it's also because obviously I'm in control when I'm asking the questions, mostly. Obviously you can have a guest who might go off in some direction that you don't necessarily expect or want, maybe, I don't know. But yeah, so it's really strange for me to kind of be in that position where you don't know where it's going to go. You don't know what they're going to ask and you don't know whether you can answer the question. But I'm quite good at not answering the question. You'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's deflecting.
My favourite one is to go, I remember sometimes when I was reporting on the news and a presenter would ask a question that I didn't want to or didn't have the answer to. I go, that's a really good question. Anyway, let me tell you, blah.
Deflection.
So that is a gift to everybody, okay?
that's a sort of politician's technique as well, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's quite useful sometimes if you... Just to remember that if you're in any awkward situation. Good question. Because then the presenter goes, oh, I asked a good question.
Yes.
So they're not concentrating.
I love it when guests say, oh, that is a good question. And I think, was it that good, though? I don't think it was that good.
Yeah, there you go. You're right, Giles.
Yeah.
A little sceptical.
I have become a bit cynical.
Good comment, Giles. Good comment.
Yeah. Yeah, good insight.
Anyway, so the answer is yes, I don't like answering. It's not that I don't like it. I just feel it's just unfamiliar territory for me. That's what it is.
Do you like it when guests do go off on a tangent? Do you follow that tangent or are you like trying to bring them back? Be like, hang on. If you know
that wandering. Would depend, I suppose, on where they're going. I would definitely listen. I mean, there are some people possibly who just want to have a certain set of questions that so they're not actually going to listen to the answer, but I would definitely listen to the answer because I think sometimes people obviously say something much more interesting in those tangents and maybe something that might need to be followed up on. It would depend on lots of things, on timings, whether you know, I thought it was relevant or that you're with, or they were doing it on purpose to not answer the question. It would really depend. Yeah.
Do you know how? Sorry, Giles. Do you know how sometimes there's always certainly maybe more so on radio than TV. I don't know, but like there's a gap. Someone will finish a question And then the presenter will wait like what feels like an eternity, but it might be like 3 seconds. Is that to make the guest carry on?
Yes.
I thought so. Yeah.
Okay. It is. And it's the most brilliant technique. And you can use that in a meeting with your boss, for example. I'm doing it to you now.
I was trying to do it back. I wasn't very good.
But also, it's very unnatural to do that as a presenter as well, because you always want to be filling the airtime, don't you? Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, that's my Achilles heel, I suppose, in life, is to always want to fill the airtime. So if it feels unnatural to you as a viewer, it's way, personally, it would be way more unnatural to me. But it's a very, it's my husband taught me that. Don't say anything. And then people fill the silence with all sorts of interesting stuff.
Exactly. Because what they've wanted to say is run out. So then they're just like, oh, I'll go into the next thing. And that might be something beautiful. You know, it could be something really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. So I think actually, but I think in awkward situations, wherever it is, in the bus or it's a really brilliant technique, actually. So well spotted.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So hang on, but in a meeting situation, because like on radio, I guess like you're not face to face. So, but like in like a personal setting, that would be really weird if you just stood there eyeballing your boss. What a power move.
What a power move. But it's silence is the most powerful thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Non-reaction is some. I read something the other day said, don't forget that no reaction is actually a reaction. Mm. But also silence is a very, and I have done it in awkward meetings, 100%. Just shut up.
I'm going to try. I mean, I'm currently unemployed, but once.
Okay, well, when you're not a boss, I don't suggest you do it in an interview situation.
Yeah, yeah.
You imagine if it works?
Jim, when you're in an interview situation, you don't want to leave them wanting more. Like, you don't want to, like, just go, look, I'm going to stop you there. I'm going to go.
Yeah. Don't call me, I'll call you.
I think in an interview situation, it's not really workable. I think in conflict situations, it's really powerful.
I am going to definitely, at some point, I'm going to employ it. And I'll let you know how it goes.
Can you let me know?
Yeah, it might be during this hour. I was going to say as well, like obviously with things like you're doing like BBC Breakfast or something like that, it's very time sensitive. So you're, and you've got someone in your ear as well. That must be quite, I can imagine like active listening is probably quite hard in those instances. Do you find it able to switch off and just concentrate on who's in front of you?
That's a good point. So I would have what's called open talkback. So that means that I could always hear what was going on in the gallery. And that's really actually in some ways not, obviously, I mean, my directors, I have to listen to them. I don't always listen to them probably, but actually it's sometimes more powerful for what they're not saying. So I can remember occasions, for example, back in the day on sort of BBC News 24, when we'd be in a massive rolling news situation and something would be going wrong, for example, with the machinery, and you would hear it before they had time for them to tell you. Do you see what I mean? So you could sort of, your brain works so quickly and so, without you even knowing it, doesn't it? So you're sort of pre-prepared. And I do remember one particular occasion, and I think we were just coming up to the top of the hour at 5 o'clock, and I could hear that something was going wrong in the gallery. And already I'm thinking, okay, so when things go wrong, what am I going to do about it? And literally we had nothing. We had no sound, no pictures. We had me and we had a political correspondent. And I, you know, you mentioned about time. I know that I asked the first question. His answer is going to be 45 seconds. And I'm thinking, I'm going to need a lot more than 45 seconds here. We did 15 minutes.
Whoa.
Before anything came back. And luckily it was a big breaking news story. So he had a lot to say and there was lots of background stuff. But so that's interesting. So I would always have that because, as I say, there's stuff that it's what they're not saying, which is really important. And then the other thing about timings is people would always worry when they came on live, because we'd have to end the program at literally to the second. And people would always worry that they would go on too long. But I'd have this body language, and it was difficult, much more difficult during COVID, because normally body language is very powerful. And I could literally shut someone up without them knowing I was shutting them up by the way I moved or the way I looked. It's really the weirdest thing. But obviously, on, you know, when you're down on a Zoom, it's a bit more difficult, really, because they can't see you. I mean, I would never, maybe on Zoom, I'm putting my hand up going, stop, but people could just carry on, can't they? So that was interesting. But I had a very good sense of time, and I test myself these days. I don't know if maybe everybody can do it. I'll go, right, what time is it before I look at my watch? And I'll normally get it to within about a minute.
Oh, that's interesting. I've got a friend who can do that. He, like, have literally, you? Yeah.
That's a skill.
Yeah. You'd say he would never, in fact, he got rid of his watch. Because he
did
know the time.
Oh, I've never dared do that.
I know, but it was like a magic trick.
When I don't have a watch.
Yeah.
But also, you know, knowing that, you know, what 30 seconds is, what 2 minutes feels like, you know, you actually have a very intuitive sense of time, which I'm not sure is a useful skill in life, really, but I've got it.
I mean, I do stand-up comedy, and actually, if you haven't got your... I always have my watch, and I have to have a Casio, so I've got a timer on it, so I can look down and see how long I've done.
So you do a timer, do you? Yeah.
Yeah, so I did the stopwatch.
Very weak lights on those, Jim, I've noticed.
Yeah.
The light on that is very weak.
It's quite off-putting if you're constantly looking at your the audience like, this guy just want to get off stage or something.
But that's why. I mean, I'm saying all of that, and then I don't trust myself, because that's why I bought a watch, because often I'm doing speeches, like, you know, about the book and stuff, lots of speeches, and actually... A watch, you can glance at it, can't you, to make sure you watch it, because you don't want to look at the time. Where does everybody else have the time? On their phone.
Yeah.
And it's so rude. You can't do that.
I agree. Yeah, it's cool. Do you? I was listening to Nikki Campbell, previous podcast as well, on Five Live yesterday, and they were doing a phone-in about the coronation, and I don't know who his researchers are, but they are fantastic, because they found the
who did they find?
Interesting. Oh, they had this one lady who was like a big royalist, and she was just brilliant. They had a real spectrum. But anyway, there was big technical issues. And at one point, the guy on the phone, like this, like, you know, public person, I think it was a bit of a anti-monarchist, was chatting, finished his bit, and there was no answer from Nikki. And the guy on the phone went, hello? Hello? It was so good. And there was nothing. And then suddenly Nikki comes back, and I think he must have lost this guy or something, because he comes back and goes, that's really interesting, great, tell me more. And the guy sort of carried on, and then his mic was up, and you heard him talking to the gallery going, can you make sure, and it was chaotic.
Oh,
and it was absolutely brilliant. I mean, he's an absolute pro, so he just went back into it, and then it was all fine. And
that is literally your worst nightmare, that your contributor is in charge of the air.
Yeah, he was hosting for about 20 seconds.
I've never even, that's never, in all my anxiety dreams, that has never occurred to me. Thanks.
I suddenly felt like I was on a phone call with this guy on my radio. Hello? I'm like, hello? Oh, no, wait, sorry, I'm not on this call. It was so weird.
Oh, my gosh. That's absolute. That's really, I'm so glad I didn't know that as a newsreader.
But in those moments, like when you were filling before, like for the 15 minutes and stuff, are you like, is part of you like enjoying the chaos of it and be like, right, I'm really in control here? Or are you going like, shit,
Louise Minchin show now.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to do stand-up. So. Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, gosh. Can I tell you? Okay,
yeah,
random. I will answer that question, come back to that. But random thing that did happen to me, which was a bit... I'll come back to the telly bit, but I was doing an awards ceremony, and I can't remember who the comedian was, and I introduced the comedian, and your entertainment tonight is Johnny Bloggs, whatever. Didn't come on the stage.
Oh, no.
And I go... Okay, I tell you what, let's see if I do that again, whether they arrive.
Oh, no.
So I go off the stage, I come back on the stage, still not there. And at that point, no, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, right, this is my moment. I'm going to have to do stand-up. Anyway, they did eventually arrive, but they weren't there. So in those moments on the telly when everything goes wrong, I think I go into a state of calm, because that's the only thing you can do. The only thing you control at that point is yourself. And so I do, you know, and that's when you're really earning your money as well, isn't it? When everything's gone wrong and you're like, okay, so it's a kind of state of calm and slow everything down.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Because your nerves are telling you to really speak really quickly, but that's the last thing you need to do. So I would just go into this kind of like really weirdly calm state. Did I enjoy it? Dan used to love that. He was just like, "Ah, this is my moment."
Really?
Yeah, but I'm not sure I would say I loved it. But I did feel one of the most crazy things that happened was we're doing the headlines, and again, to the open talk back thing, and it's coming up. I think it must have been 7 o'clock, and you'll understand why I say seven. And the editor at the time on the program comes over talk back. So he's speaking directly in my ear, and he goes, "Louise, the headline's wrong." Oh, and he goes, "Boom, boom." So literally with 0 seconds to go, he tells me the headline's wrong. So there's a few things going on there, right? Which headline?
Yeah, that would help. Yeah.
Does he mean a typo or like...
Does he mean a typo? Actual... What other questions? Yeah, exactly. Which headline? Is it a typo? Is it a libel? Is it...
Yeah.
You know, what? Give me any clue. Any clue would be great, but no clue. And the reason it was good, it was 7 o'clock, because obviously I'd read the headline at 6 o'clock. So I can't even remember what was wrong, but I fixed it.
Wow.
Live, not knowing what it was.
That's because you were in that calm, meditative, zen state that you've been able to put yourself in, which it's I would not like, be able to like be like that.
Wouldn't you?
No. I would be freaking out, I think.
Do you think something kicks in?
I think something kicks in, yeah.
You can't
something
really
must. I must be a flick that I must be able to have in my brain, which is just like... But you know, it sounds like if you have an accident or you fall over, time seems to sort of stretch and slow and be weird. It's a bit like that. Time becomes something that is different. So I had more seconds, though I didn't, to fix the headline.
I mean, that is incredible. Also, I think as well, things are never quite as bad as you think in your head. I've done.
Oh, I don't know.
TV. Campbell.
Go on. You've done TV.
I don't know, just a bit of the past. I'm like done. Thought at the time, oh, that's terrible, and then watched it back and think, oh, actually, I don't think anyone's going to notice that. I think it would be all right, but I don't know.
Okay, this is good.
Sense of...
We're going to get our first good question quote here. Well, I'm just saying, like, with regards to, I was going to say to you about, you know, how you deal with those things, like when you think things are not quite going right. How are you a perfectionist with those things? Also, I was going to say, with regards to, it's almost sounds like there is a kind of a bit of an adrenaline rush going through that whole show. Must be a little bit of a come down when you finished the show. There things that you have to do? I mean, I know you're into exercise and stuff, and I wonder if that's come out of the back of being highly kind of charged all the time. But
so many questions there,
Jeff. I know. Well, I think start there. The perfectionism is interesting as well, but start with
okay. Remember, remind
are you sure about this good question thing, Giles?
yeah, I'm waiting for the silence.
Are you writing down the light? Let's start with adrenaline.
I've got my notes.
Okay, have you? So adrenaline, definitely, 100% running on adrenaline has a big impact actually on you. So you know. I mean, I got better at it, and I think you learn to, you know, definitely would have adrenaline, but you learn, don't you? Every time something happens, every time, you know, it's like, but you get used to stuff. Mm-hmm. And I definitely, I mean, I was on air between 6 and 9:15, and there is not a moment really of respite. There's 2.5 minutes in each hour when, if you're lucky, you can rush to the loo. sorry, too many details probably, but there's no downtime in that. And yeah. I would find the impact of that. I was absolutely exhausted by it.
I bet.
So I would come off air and just like literally half an hour later, 45 minutes later, fall asleep, really just out, just completely like computer switched off. So is that perfect? And then the exercise. We'll do the exercise bit next, shall we?
Yeah. Sorry, and I did sort of bombard you there with lots.
I
of
might
questions.
Come back to perfectionism, or maybe I won't. So exercise definitely helped me with that because. So I would first of all be absolutely so tired that I would fall asleep and sort of in a sort of you know really catatonic state, and then you know you still got this. I mean, I'm not a scientist, not a biologist, not a doctor, but sort of cortisol, haven't you, running around your system? Yeah. And actually, I found. Which may be wrong, that exercise really helped to kind of move that along a bit. And to have some time where, you know, I was swimming or running where nothing too much is going on in my brain. And I don't run with music or I don't run with podcasts. Or I didn't used to. I do now, but that's probably because things have changed, hasn't it? But just to have the bit of mental quietness in my brain, which I really needed to be the counterbalance to that busyness.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's something to be said for actually having that quiet and turning the noise off. And actually when you're out in nature as well, just being with it, being with the sounds of the earth. That sounds, doesn't sound too wanky.
By the water or whatever. For me, it's I love sea. That would be my... And then, you know, so that's definitely a counterbalance. Perfectionism, oh gosh. I mean, you know, the beautiful thing about live telly is it's live and you can't go back and repeat your sentence. But the awful thing is that... It's live, so you can make mistakes. And I always felt that, and I'm, you know, I may be overthinking it, but I always sort of felt that I was within half a second of losing my career. And it may not have been my fault.
Yeah.
So that half second of, you know, the headline's wrong, you know, and it could be somebody else's. I mean, I always felt, you know, that was my job to sort of get everybody out of the problems. But yeah, it was always that sort of, again, adding to that adrenaline of like any moment of today could be the day, especially in the world that we live in now where, you know, there's so much scrutiny, rightly so, a lot of it, but everything's on YouTube forever and ever. And, you know, there's so many people, not so many people, because not everybody's like that, but, you know, there could be something I just really messed up on. And, so I used to, at the beginning, really look back at a lot of stuff. And then I got a bit better at just thinking, well, you know what? They're letting me carry on. It must be okay. Let's just go with that.
Well, also, I think
audiences... You can't be a perfectionist if it's live. You can't. You just can't. Nothing can be not everything can be perfect, can it?
No, I think audiences are also forgiving of live TV.
Some are.
I think they quite like it when stuff goes wrong on live
TV. Oh, they
TV,
love
it.
Yeah, they love that. And then my worst one was, I don't know if you've seen it, but when I let the mosquitoes out live on national television.
No.
Oh my gosh. And then just, that was funny, but I just got the most terrible, terrible giggles for like 2 days. 2 days. But yeah, people love that. People love that, don't they? And you're human and stupid, and I'm very stupid sometimes.
But it is human, I think.
Yeah, it definitely is. I was going to say, did you go for a period of like, I mean, we've referred to this on the podcast before, this sort of post-match analysis, like where you would be kind of analysing what you'd done over a course of a show and worrying about certain aspects of it?
I didn't too much because I just think to what end? I mean, yeah, to the end that you could make things better. And there's certainly interviews that I think maybe, you know, if it'd been a big interview, I would sort of think, could I have done that slightly better or would it have been better on this structure? But I just think I would just got lost down a rabbit hole then because it would have been relentless and too much. And of course there were things that I worried about and all the rest of it. But yeah, I didn't find that a very useful tool for me. I just thought that was very, really negative. But definitely there were things that I'd be going thinking, oh, maybe I should have tried this or done that. Or I just found that preparing was better than post-match analysis for me, you know, to make sure I'd read the book and I'd thought about the interview and I'd thought about the questions and done all of that. That was better for me than kind of going over stuff which I couldn't fix.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's
is that your rule, Jim?
Is that it?
No, I don't have any rules when it comes to
you're a maverick when it comes to this stuff.
I make them intentionally just to try and get attention. You know, my favourite ever, and I think it was on BBC News 24, is when the guy who was the taxi driver.
The wrong guest.
Oh, God, I love it. His face. And then he just like tries to be the guest and starts answering the question.
Somebody put it up the other day. I saw it recently on Twitter or something again. My gosh. I mean, that was
what an absolute hero.
It was just brilliant, wasn't it? Absolutely brilliant. I've been there when somebody's done, when we've had the wrong guest as well, but I don't think it was me talking to them. But
it's mortifying.
You wouldn't think it was easily done, would you?
But it must happen. We were just saying earlier, we're all human. Errors happen. So people or whatever. Like,
wouldn't get to the set, but I love that. No, it's absolutely brilliant. God bless him. He's probably still out there making, hopefully he's still making money on the back of that because he deserves it.
He just like stepped up to the plate and just started answering. And his answers were quite good as well.
It's actually better than the expert they were going to
be. I remember there was a, I was sitting next to someone. I'm not going to say who the presenter it was. And he was talking to a guest and he thought the interview was about football, the presenter, and the guest didn't. And he was asking a question about football. And the guest was going, in Iraq? And it went on for like three or four questions. And I think I'd realised I was going...
Yeah, I don't think this is football.
Sorry, you can't see that on the pod. I was going, wrong guest, is what I was saying. But yeah, I mean, super awkward. So awful. Awful.
Oh, God. But good TV.
Yeah.
Good TV. If you're not the person.
Not great for the people, yeah.
I have one Dan Walker anecdote.
Go on.
From 2015 or 16. I did a thing with him for joe.co.uk. And a football thing. He had to kick a football really hard.
Yeah.
At you?
And not at me, at a goal.
No, just.
And he was super lovely. But like, then he wanted me to then like G him up and that wasn't working. So then he wanted me to like abuse him. So I found myself standing in this like football pitch going, you got terrible hair, Dan Walker. You got terrible shoes. It was a very weird day in my life. And then right at the end, I accidentally... sort of pied him off, but he went to shake my hand. I hadn't noticed. So, like,
oh no, brilliant.
Looks so good. But yeah, so I just thought I'd chuck in my little anecdote there. But he was lovely.
He was very funny. So and we're both competitive, right? Mm. And, but against each other. And no, well, lots of things. But so he and I, we would always be, there was stuff that we had to do where, there was one where we had a scare electrics in the studio. This sounds ridiculous.
Sounds amazing, actually.
But you'd love this, Charles. So we had to control the scare electrics with our brain waves.
What?
Exactly.
What is this? What is this?
Exactly. So
sounds very one show, actually.
It does. Exactly. I don't know why we're doing it on purpose. And so we had to put these headsets on, and it's out there on the internet somewhere. We had to put these headsets on, and then our brain waves would literally power the scare electrics. But in order to make it power it, you had to think no thoughts.
Oh, that's impossible.
Okay.
That's like Ghostbusters.
Tell if you're doing that.
I don't know, because it's whatever. Your brain waves would be... Anyway, it is, isn't it? And I do remember sitting there and thinking, right, obviously I want to beat Dan at this.
I'm going to think less thoughts than him.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great thing, isn't it? I have no thoughts. This is how good I am. And I did. I absolutely smashed it.
Hey.
Because I was thinking, I went back to a moment where... in a triathlon where I'd been in this crazy washing machine of the triathlon, and at the beginning somebody pulled my goggles off and, you know, dunked my head down. It was all really stressful. It was in the docks in Liverpool, and I'd been swimming along, and then suddenly I got to a bit of calm water and everything calmed down. I went to this like zen-like state that we're talking about, and I looked down and all these little blue fish floating about, and I go, oh, that's amazing, the fish have come out to see me. And I went to this really, this is such a powerful place for me. And and then I realized they were jellyfish, but they were still okay. But every time I'm in a really stressful situation, I think back to how I felt in that moment. I can feel the coldness of the water on my hands. And so I did that with the scare electrics and absolutely smashed it. Anyway, so then there were all sorts of things. Like, we built a rocket and we had to fire it. And then we were doing a skipping match and and every single time I would beat him for exactly the reason that you were saying, that I would just focus, concentrate, keep skipping. And Dan would be like so excited and, you know, thinking about, you know, how the audience were looking. And I just was like, I just have to tap it out. It's so easy. He just beats himself.
But what that what a powerful technique to have. And especially the feeling it, I think, like,
yeah,
because that then probably like influences the rest of your kind of brain, I guess.
It probably does, doesn't it? It's probably something. There's probably something going on there that I can't even explain. But it's just literally the feeling on my hands. And I remember having to do something. Oh, I was doing something in, I think, in the Royal Albert Hall, a massive audience, super scary, live on radio too. And just before I'm going on, I can feel that. I know that, you know, that moment before you're going on stage, and maybe use it. You probably use it in a different way. I get really nervous, really nervous.
Me too.
And I just go back to that moment, and every time it just changes something in my psyche that I can hopefully cope with stuff.
Yeah, I've been doing a bit of meditation in the last few months, and it's really hard, actually. I mean, I do guided ones because I can't.
Yeah.
Just sitting there kind of trying to do it myself, I find I'm just too like off on tangents. So the guided, like having someone speaking to me on an app or whatever, is much more helpful. But it is amazing when you do get into that. Very, like I say, that zen-like state.
Yeah.
And you are kind of visualizing and feeling like, you know, with meditation, you're kind of feeling your body more and all that kind of stuff. It is quite miraculous, actually, that we can do that.
I think you're right. It's probably really, I mean, if I could give any advice to anybody, if they could find that magic key that I've got, it's very helpful, isn't it? In all sorts of situations where you don't, it's good to try and, I mean, I try, you know, try to remember that I've got it sometimes. It would be the harder thing, actually.
Mm.
But yeah, I'm sure we've all got a space in our lives where things have been zen or whatever it is, flow, or whatever they call it.
Our happy place.
Happy place. Yeah. Strangely happy place.
Yeah, a weirdly happy place. But I'm just thinking, I don't think I have one. So to get one, I basically need to do a triathlon in Liverpool.
You don't have to do a triathlon in Liverpool. I don't know, just... Could be at the park throwing a ball.
Mate, it could be like controlling Skeletrics, your brain.
Yeah, exactly. Look what I've been able to do with my brain.
Oh, I'd love a Zen moment. I've had a Zen moment in 3.5 years.
Have you not?
That's having children, isn't it?
Yeah. I'd love a Zen. I must have had one. I'm gonna after this pod, think about that. Yeah. There must have been one at some point.
There must have been one. I'm sure there is one. Or find one. Make one.
Make one. Yeah, make one.
Make one, mate.
Yeah. Don't do it.
I like that. Yeah.
So, Louis, I'll let you know. I want to talk about your new book, but can we go back and talk a bit about how you got into all this, like, you know, becoming a journalist and being on TV? You were born in British Hong Kong, right?
I was born in Hong Kong, yeah.
And
a while back.
Yeah. Not that long. So were you there for a long time?
No, I wasn't. I was there. My dad was in the army and I was there till I was about, I think, only like 4.5 or something.
Okay.
So I do have flashes of memory about it. I do remember, I think, because, you know, that back that age, you don't really remember very much, do you? No. I think I remember being, we used to live on the top of a block of tower of flats, and obviously there were big, not tornadoes, but huge storms. And typhoons. And I remember sitting, my mum says I was born in a typhoon. That's why I'm so, I never sit still. I was born in a typhoon, but I don't know if that's why I don't ever sit still. But I do remember being in the bath, and the bath, because they had to sway, because if they didn't sway, they'd fall. And then the bath water moving because of the wind.
Wow. Okay. Like, wow.
That. And then family legend has it that I could swim pretty much before I could walk. And I've always loved swimming. So I don't remember it very well, but I do the little flashes that I remember. I think I remember.
Yeah, interesting. When I was one, we lived in Malaysia.
Oh, did you?
A place called Kuala Nerang. When I found out you lived in Hong Kong, I had to text my mum this morning to remind us where. But it was from like literally 0 to 1 because of dad's job, and then we came back.
Right.
He was helping build a dam in Malaysia. Not physically, he was an accountant. He'd have been terrible at actually building the dam, but he was like part of the... But yeah, so I'm always weird. Again, can't remember any of it, but like weirdly quite proud of having lived abroad. It's a weird sort of weird feeling.
I mean, you know, I'm not afraid to move. And, you know, when we moved to Salford, when Breakfast moved to Salford, and there was a lot of negativity around it, I'm like, well, I mean, you know, it's not, you know, they have schools and stuff there. They have a lot more. Yeah. I mean, I've loved it. I have absolutely changed our life by moving here. We love living in the Northwest. But I think it probably because I had been born not in this country, then it just something in your DNA gives certainly perhaps a little bit more openness to doing something different, probably. So the journalism thing, Giles, was I loved. I mean, I'm just looking. I've just put all a bookshelf up here with all my children's books that they read, but also books that I read when I was a child. I was obsessed by reading, absolutely obsessed. Yeah. And the reason I'm wearing glasses is because I used to literally read by torchlight underneath the covers when I supposedly had my lights out. And then obsessed by stories and storytelling and also by news. And when I was, I think very young, like 9 or 10, my bedtime listening was The World Tonight, which is A, really late, and B, full of really bad news stories.
Yeah.
So I don't know what my parents were doing letting me do that. But so journalism was, or storytelling was very much part of what I would, you know, enjoyed. And then when I went to uni, you know, I did all those things that everybody does, which is like write for the uni magazine, which was super awkward because I think I've somewhere in this desk got the first article, which is.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly 4 decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Excruciatingly
amazing,
but great that you've got it still there. That stuff,
yeah, it's somewhere. It's definitely, I know it's somewhere. And then, so I was at uni, did study lots of different things at Scottish University at St Andrews, and then studied Spanish at the end, and then spent a year living in Latin America in Argentina, which I loved. Completely changed my life, fell in love with the language and the literature. Came back still, you know, writing for the newspaper. I say writing, it was so embarrassing. And then left uni and I didn't know had no clue what I wanted to do. In those days, I don't know, one of you might remember, in those days you applied, you got your jobs through The Guardian, the newspaper.
Oh, wow.
The Media Guardian, you won't remember that, at the back, right? And there was this little advert, I can still see it in black and white, for looking for translators to go to Chile on expedition for 3 months and work as an interpreter. And I spoke Spanish and Latin American Spanish. So I thought, well, that'd be fun. Went there, aged 22 or something, and had to do, because I was one of the only people on the expedition who spoke Spanish, had to do all the interviews. I mean, I was so young, it's sort of ridiculous, but nobody else, the expedition leader couldn't do the interviews. So I do them. And I just remember sitting, like we are now, in a tiny radio station in the middle of Patagonia with probably 4 listeners and the guy asking me these questions. And I just looked at him and I was like, I want your job. I want to be asking questions. And that was the key. That was sort of unlocked the rest of my career, really. Came back and worked in very, 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 I feel really lucky when I think about it and talk to other people about career paths. I knew what I wanted to do, and I think that's, you're so lucky if that happens to you, aren't you? So I came back, worked for the Latin American section of the World Service, speaking English. We spoke really hilarious. If you didn't speak English and Spanish, you wouldn't have understood any conversation.
Okay.
Because
it was hybrid, was it?
We spoke Spanglish. It was like, pasame los scissors. So that's pass me the scissors. It's probably obvious, but maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And then worked on that. I'm trying to do this quickly because it's, anyway, worked on the, worked from there, went from there to the Today program, making tea, getting getting John Humphrey's his Alpen with Skinny Milk. That was my job. I was radio production assistant. And also realized quite quickly that because I had radio production assistant on my forehead, that's what I was always going to be. There was so much kind of like so many barriers to moving on. And they just literally, I might as well have had really thick written on my forehead because that's where I'd gone in. And that utterly unbelievable, isn't it? Really?
Yeah.
I had a degree in Spanish. I mean, you know, yeah. And then realized that if I stayed in that path, I was never going to be what I wanted to be, which was a reporter. So I went back to uni and got a diploma in radio journalism. And John Humphrey said, look, go to local radio. That's what you need to do. Go and work, you know, learn your craft, where he said it doesn't matter. Of course it matters.
It doesn't count there.
Yeah, I made a lot of mistakes, which my mum has still got on tape. Patchy crowds instead of patchy clouds, stuff like that, and learned my craft in Radio Berkshire. And, you know, that from there on, just kind of carried on that path and got lucky in lots of different ways, struggled sometimes, and eventually made it to the BBC Breakfast Sofa.
I wonder if that path has changed now, because I did journalism at uni, worked for my local newspaper, and I've said on the pod before, closed the edition because the circulation was so low. But that's another story. But that was the path very much. Go and do local, work your way up and stuff. I wonder if that path's changed now. I don't know if that's still a... mainly because a lot of local stuff isn't there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely gutting, isn't it? So many, you know, if you look at what's going on in BBC local radio at the moment, in all the papers and all the rest of it. But I think there are a lot of openings as well for people in some ways, aren't they? Because if I was doing it again, I would be telling me, right, Louise, go blog, go be on Twitter, go, you know, there's a huge audience out there. And if anybody was looking for a job, you know, if I was in a position to give people jobs, that's what the first thing I'd do, go look and see what they've done. Because it's all out there.
Proactive.
Yeah, it's all broadcast. You know, that's what you should be doing. But I think it was hard then. I think it is hard now as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. I think, like you say, there are other platforms, stuff like YouTube and all sorts of stuff you can access. But obviously then that means there's a lot more people can access it. So like the competition's even greater, maybe. I don't know.
I think what you lose massively from what we had was I was sort of adopted by a mentor when I was in Radio Berkshire, who just, I mean, he must have seen something in me which I didn't see at the time. And he went out of his way to really invest in me, spend time with me, help me, taught me how to write. I mean, just what an incredible gift. So I think that's what you miss out on, isn't it? That you get that kind of personal relationship with somebody who, for what reasons unknown to myself, really took time to sort of launch me onto my career, actually. So that, yeah, that's really hard for people.
Yeah, it's so interesting because it comes up most episodes that there's that one person
that's
like, yeah, honestly, yeah, whether it's mentors, a teacher or someone they've worked with, or you know, like an older actor in a theatre company, or whatever it might be, there's generally someone along the way who has just, I don't know, like you say, been very hands-on and helped you in lots of different ways, or they might have said one thing to you that's like kind of propelled you forward. It's quite interesting how we've all kind of got that one person, perhaps.
I think it's really important to remember that when you're my stage in my career as well, that I could hopefully, I don't know, be that for someone or, you
Definitely.
Know, to kind of give back, you know, to put your hand down, isn't it? And pull somebody else up as well.
Yeah.
So I've been so busy writing the book this year that I haven't done that much of it, but I do in lockdown, I did a coaching mentoring course and I did
amazing.
Do quite a lot of chatting with young women actually trying to get into journalism, and they've done, oh my gosh, I look at them some now and I'm like, my gosh, it's amazing, it's brilliant.
Well, there's sometimes I think also
you can, with me, but
sometimes you can be a mentor inadvertently, like you don't even realize, you know, even if it's just like inspiring someone in some way, people might look up to you in that way, won't they? Let's talk about the book because it's fantastic.
Thanks for reading it.
You're very welcome. So what I was going to say was, tell me a bit about the process of it. How did it come about? What, you know, what inspired you to do it?
Love process.
Yeah, process is a great one.
I listen to lots of podcasts about writers because I love process. So
yeah,
thank
me too.
You. Process.
Yeah.
First one, so I wrote a book already called Dare to Try, and I was kind of doing this crazy journey where I hadn't done any sport for years and suddenly took it up and then decided that I'd try and compete for my age group in triathlon and in World and European Championships. So that's the story of the first book. And I'd sort of been thinking about, should I be writing it? And I got this email, and we all get random emails, don't we? So I got an email from Matt from Bloomsbury saying, hi, my name's Matt. I'm from Bloomsbury. I'd really like to talk to you about writing a book about your triathlon journey. And I was like, yeah, right. He's so not from Bloomsbury. good line.
Spam alert.
Ignored it. He wrote again. And I was like, oh, gosh. Oh, maybe he is from Bloomsbury. So I did what I should have done and sort of Googled Matt from Bloomsbury. Yeah, turned out he was from Bloomsbury. He was serious. Anyway, so I met him and he asked me to write that first book. That was about 5 years ago. And then, you know, it's always that second difficult album, I think, isn't it? It's done okay. And it's still selling now, which is fantastic. And they wanted me to write another one, but it just took me a long time. You know, you both know this. You're creative. It takes, maybe you find it easy, but I don't.
Writing's hard.
Writing.
Anyone else say anything different, but then it's really hard to do.
Yeah. And you can't write, or I certainly can't, unless I'm 100% behind the idea. Anyway, I was sitting on the BBC breakfast sofa. Oh, I was actually about to go on breakfast. And, you know, I've already indicated I love sport. I love endurance sport. I love hearing, you like process about writing. I like hearing about marathons and what you ate and, you know, all that. So that's really my passion. And I just sat there one morning and we were doing an interview with a man about an incredible, intrepid adventure. And I just spotted an absence that I hadn't realized was there. I was like, where are the women doing these incredible, courageous things? Where are they? Is it that they're not doing it? I think we know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it that we're just not telling their stories? And in my view, I don't think we tell women's stories of endeavor, should we say, as much as we do men, or celebrate them. And you can argue all the reasons why, but I'm not really... That's to me a kind of like boring argument. I'm just like, let's just go do it. Let's tell their stories. So I went back to Bloomsbury and said, I want to write a story about amazing women doing things in sport and outdoors, and I want to go and do it with them. And luckily they said yes.
So proper gonzo journalism.
Gonzo.
Yeah.
Is that gonzo journalism?
It is when you're doing it with them, yeah. When you're doing,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, Hunter, so you're like Thompson style.
Yeah, like Hunter S. Thompson.
I think you have to take more drugs.
I didn't do any of that.
It's like going method if you're an actor. It's like,
oh,
you know,
yeah, I went.
Method, yeah, that's,
I mean,
better,
you've
yeah.
read it. I went method with a big M, massive method. And, you know, and we're talking, I know because you've read it, but free diving under ice in the dark, cycling across Argentina. What else? Swimming from Alcatraz with sharks.
Yeah, I mean, the Alcatraz thing is just crazy, right?
I think that was, talk about method, that was one of the reasons. So I talked to Matt from Bloomsbury about the idea behind the book. And then you've got, you know, it's not that simple, is it, Giles? They don't go, oh, yeah, write it.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to sell it. It's got to go to the sales team.
Yeah, yeah, you've got to put a pitch together.
Yeah, the pitch. So swimming from Alcatraz was number one in the pitch. And it is not, it's the first chapter in the book. And it was really exhilarating, shall I say. So I met these two, and every chapter is a different woman who's done something incredible in sport and me going doing something adventure with them. But actually this chapter is two young women. They're called Mitali and Anaya, and they're 20 and 17, and they have done the swim from Alcatraz with no wetsuit 77 times.
It's crazy.
Oh,
like,
God.
One of them did it when she was 8. What? She was 8. Gosh. Oh, well, anyway, so I basically set out all these different, and that was talk about method again. So obviously when I did the pitch, though, I had about 10, maybe 8 or 10 women in my pitch, and then we just thought, right, okay, so who are we going to put in the book? And we had this meeting, and we literally, there were 100 women that we could have put in the book, but I couldn't do 100 adventures, and I wanted it to be diverse in lots of different ways, by the person, the type of people they were, in age, in everything, and also by the type of thing that we did. So as I say, you've got diving, you've got hiking, you've caving. Got indoor climbing, caving.
I mean, that terrifies me, the idea of that.
Yeah, oh. Same.
Oh, I'm glad you say that, because I thought I was a bit of a wimp.
I would not get close.
So this is wild caving, it's called. And it's wild because where do we begin? There's nothing.
There's
down
no safety.
There in this cave. There's no safety. There's nothing there.
Your insurance company must have been like, absolutely no way are we covering you through any of this.
I didn't get any insurance.
Oh my God.
Should I have?
You were swimming with sharks and going down random holes.
Bloomsbury, you're like, oh, I don't know if we've got liability cover for this, but yeah, go for it.
Just see what happens.
It never occurred to me. That's the optimist.
Long as you hit the deadline, we don't care how many limbs you come back with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I did fear for my life. So in the book, there's what I call genuine fearing for my life and ridiculous fearing for my life. So actually caving is not genuine. So caving, so this lady I went with called Christine Grossart, and she is a cave explorer, diver. So her idea of a fun time is to get her scuba gear, go into a cave, crawl through a skinny gap, get to a sump, it's called. So dive in that sump. And then this one she'd done in Croatia. I get quite over-exercised when I talk about it, don't I? She goes into the sump with, it's pitch black. I mean, the blackness is like God. A velvet blanket of black hole around you. She goes down, swims along with a little thing like that straight out of James Bond, a little machine, dragging her, comes up to another hole, goes something like 7 kilometres under the ground like this.
I mean, nuts, isn't it? If you think
we only did
it.
2 hours. It's nuts, isn't it?
Yeah.
We only did 2 hours. I thought I would walk into a big cave, we'd see some lovely stalagmites, and then we might do a little yeah. bit of bouldering. No, we go through this tiny hole, drop straight into blackness with water. I mean, it's utterly terrifying. And but it is sort of ridiculous. So I just thought I was going to die, because obviously the mountain that's been there for many thousands of years would choose the moment that I'm in the cave to collapse.
Of course.
Yeah.
Obviously. I'm really claustrophobic. Oh, the whole thing was very, very challenging. We went 2 hours in, and then when you're 2 hours in, you're just thinking, and I'm coming back to all that jellyfish, try and be zen. I mean, it was really not working for me. Wow. Having little quiet words with myself, going, Louise, the more you panic, the worse it is. But I'm panicking. Oh,
well, anyway, you talk about that. I think you said to her like something is like, is this fear normal or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course it is. But like, I suppose if you do it on a regular basis, you know.
That's what she likes.
Yeah.
But what I love about all these women, they're all pushing barriers, you know, and boundaries in different, you know, for me, that was super challenging. For her, it was not challenging at all. But everybody's boundary is different. And it's interesting to be, you know, exploring your own when you're looking at someone else's as well. But she's an amazing lady.
Has she not heard of just like going for tea and cake?
No, that is literally her. That's what she does at the weekends. She spends all her time, and she's very honest about it, actually, is Jazz, isn't she? Saying that,
yeah,
you know, that she doesn't have children or a partner. She is absolutely, this is her mission in life. And, you know, she explores, she's gone to places that no other humans have gone to. So we can all look, she said, makes the point, you can look at space and you can sort of map it out. You can look at deep water and map it out, but you cannot map all these tiny little tunnels that are in our amazing world. And that's what she is. She's an explorer.
Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of it, is that you are finding these things that other people wouldn't have seen. It might be the first time someone's clapped eyes on that space.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's explored this cave system in Croatia. Now she found these sort of, you know, went seven, I think it was 7 kilometers deep. And she's, you know, her next mission will be to go back again. Incredible woman.
You know how like do those things get named? You know, like if you like go on the moon.
Oh yes, that's a good point. That's a very good point. I don't know, because it should certainly be named after her, shouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Still, even now, however long, I can't remember quite when I did the caving, but it still makes me feel a bit nervous.
Oh, it would make me, yeah. 100%.
Well, I like the fact that she was like constantly, obviously, trying to persuade you to like be in love with it. You're like, kind of.
That's so bad.
It doesn't sound like you're still coming around to the idea.
No, I'm not coming around to the idea. I'm never coming around. As I said, when I got out, I still stand by what, when I get out of that cave, I just said to her, there is not enough money in the world to make me do that again.
Yeah.
So I'm still stand by.
On that, are there things within the book that you have done again or would do again,
I guess? The one thing that I really I've been thinking about it a bit this week, actually, because I've been down in Cornwall and you can do it there, is free diving.
Okay.
So free diving is, it's Avatar, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you go underwater and you can do it lots of different ways. You can go literally just go underwater and not move, or you can go underwater, go down deep, you can go along, lots of different things. But it's diving with no air. So it's all about breath work. It's all about, you know, being, I mean, and it's very unsafe. You have to be very, very, you know, this is something you never do alone. You never, you know, you train. When Kath Pendleton, who asked me to go free diving with her, she's an ice swimmer and she's swum the most southernmost mile in the Antarctic Circle. So I just thought, oh yeah, you know, I love scuba, I love swimming.
I thought he was like, oh, you know, yeah, piece of piss.
What could be so hard? Yeah, it's really hard. So I had to go and do a course, first of all. And then because we'd sort of slightly got our logistics, we were just both really busy. We got to Finland where we were going to do this free diving, because also, if you're going to do your first free dive, why wouldn't you do it under the ice in the dark? I mean,
of course,
makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So we didn't really mean to do it in the dark first time, but we arrived in Finland late at night and literally our first dive. So the triangle is cut into ice, which is a meter thick.
Wow.
And you have to pull yourself under, take a breath, obviously, pull yourself under and swim 15 meters under the ice to the next hole, which was very challenging, but utterly brilliant. I mean, it really was.
When you come out then, are you sort of, is it sort of like Wim Hof territory where you're suddenly like rushing with endorphins and stuff and you're feeling
absolutely
all amazing?
Yeah. But there's so much, it was just such a brain overload. So first of all, you have to pull yourself under the ice and you're really buoyant and you don't realize any of this until you've done it for the first time. So actually you're pressed up against the ice, and obviously there's no air between the ice and the water. So you can't sort of swim because you're pressed up against the ice, and then it's completely dark.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying.
Incredibly disorientating. But I had, again, one of those moments where I went, you know, for the first, you know, it's about 25 seconds, actually, 30 seconds, the distance, the way I swim it. And I had a wonderful moment when it was all great. And then I had complete and utter panic attack, thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to die. I'm never going to get to the other side. Catherine, you know, my family, my life is flashing ahead of me.
Of course,
you come out. And I came out, Kath came out swearing, and she never swears. And I came out laughing my head off. With adrenaline. And went straight back and did it again.
Oh my God. But all these things must give you like a real like gratitude for life kind of.
Oh yeah. Oh
like,
my gosh.
Thank God I'm alive. Like this is, you know, all this kind of stuff.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com. Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Yeah, no, there's that. And there's also, I think there's also a powerful thing, which means that, you know, I know that I can do things which I find hard. and get through them okay. And I think you can take that into lots of parts of your life, can't you? Whatever, you know, whatever issues at home or issues at work. And I think that's, for me, the power of adventure is to kind of like give you confidence in a way that, you know, for example, I just did the London Marathon with my daughter and it was really hard. And she's much younger than me. And I just knew that I really wanted to run it together because I know that in my head, I can do that. And I'm not saying it's not going to hurt and it's not going to take ages and all the rest of it. But, and there was a moment when she really needed me to be that person when I'm like, you know what? You can do, and once you've done something tough like that, I know for her, now she's got through that, she'll be able to do other tough things. So I think it's really helpful for me to do other things as well.
Yeah, building that resilience.
In a healthy way,
though, because you know we can have resilience, but it's come from a negative experience.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point. So I think you're right. It's not because you've had something horrible. You know, these are all choices. You know, all these women have chosen to do it as their passion, and it does. That's not to say it's not hard and it doesn't push at their edges, but they have chosen to do that.
Tell me about like finding these various different people.
Back to the process.
I'm always in the process. Come on.
Can we get to the writing bit in a minute?
Definitely.
So process. So I didn't know. There's one of them I knew. I knew Lucy Gossage. She is very briefly a cancer oncologist and also 14 times Ironman champion. Did both at the same time. Yeah. Totally inspirational. One of the reasons why I'd written the book. I don't think, apart from her, I'd actually met any of them. And I just literally, like Giles, you and I have met on Twitter, effectively, haven't we?
Yeah.
I literally DM'd them on Instagram.
Perfect.
Hi, I'm Louise. I'm writing this book. Do you want to be in it? Should we go do something fun? Mimi, I'd never met. We met at Heathrow Airport, about to go on this lunatic trip. We were meant to be cycling across Chile and Argentina, but because of COVID, things got really complicated. I'd never met her. I spent every single hour of two weeks, not one more than 1 meter away from her. So that was lucky we got on.
Yeah, handy.
Yeah, imagine if you hadn't. Oh, God, it's been a long 2 weeks.
Oh, this is the first one of the book as well.
What was really lovely was people were so, you know, all of them were so generous with their response and with their time. And, you know, inviting me into their lives. And it was amazing. I've got obviously a phone and I tried to, you know, like record stuff as I went along. And then I just found that really distracting, actually. So I'd record a bit, you know, maybe my thoughts when I was going somewhere or thoughts afterwards. And then a little bit of an interview, you know, wherever we were. And then I'd kind of write, you know, probably do a sort of like a post-match interview afterwards, write it up, and then think, actually, I really want to explore a bit of this or that with them. So yeah, it was a sort of mixture of, you know, a little bit of quotes from there and then quotes afterwards as well.
Yeah. Must be doing so much. Like, do you worry afterwards, like, you're not going to forget like any of these bits that happen because you're having these physical reactions. I think when you're having physical, that makes memories stick, doesn't it?
Neuroplasticity, I suppose.
Emotions and physical feelings. I think, is that right? I might have made that up.
Well, sounds good. I think it does sound good. I took a lot of photos actually because I'm a very visual person, so I take photos of the rocks you know, the color of the trees and things like that. So a lot of those are very helpful to me, and I think there's something for me again about that, you know, we come to that feeling in my hands with the jellyfish. Yeah, I think I am a very visceral, physical person. So I do, you're right. They're sort of imprinted on my brain actually. And there's a lot of stuff I remembered that I didn't, you know, if you'd asked me, I wouldn't necessarily, you know, once you start writing it, things come back to you as well, don't they? And I love the writing process. Actually, I do love writing. I think the most difficult thing about writing is sitting down to do the writing.
Yeah, it's all up here. It's fine. Like, you kind of write it. It's written in your head, but actually sitting down doing it. And with regards to that, is it sitting in front of a screen writing? Is that, or making notes? How do you do that part of it? Because that's always interesting.
How do I do that? Sometimes I'll have like a bit. I've only just thrown away actually the post-it notes from my previous book.
Okay,
like,
you're one of those people.
So I have a bit of post-it notes, and then I write my notes about explore, you know, whatever, like there'll be a thought that I need, no needs expansion, but I'll write it down, the thought, because that might go and then I'll forget it. I also did, it depended on the chapter, but some of it I would like print it. So, you know, if I'd had a lot of interviews, I'd transcribe them and then print them out and then do a sort of like a massive sort of jigsaw puzzle. So it's quite physical, but also, you know, just sit down, write. I wouldn't write longhand, always write at my computer.
Yeah.
And I'm quite good. I'm better now. I used to always think I had to be in a certain place. I'm like, this book needs to get done. It can get done on the train if necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not saying that's where my most creative thought is.
No,
there is an element of it needs to get done at some point. So
yeah, just focus.
Yeah, exactly.
And so writing in general, is that something that you just want to keep doing more of? I mean,
I'm writing again.
Are you? Amazing.
I can't tell you.
No.
Oh, that's nice. Okay.
But, you know, obviously these have been non-fiction books. Would you consider doing like a fiction?
I'm writing.
Oh, okay. There you go then.
I'm super excited about writing. I just find it... It's a weird thing, isn't it? I was thinking the other day, is it a really selfish pursuit? I don't know. Is it, Giles? Tell me. What do you think, both of you? Jim?
For me, it's always been an outlet, actually.
I think
you find, particularly if you're writing fiction, actually, you will find there's elements of yourself that get put in there without even kind of realizing it. So I've always used it as
politician's
answer.
Yeah, it's a good question. That
I find there's there's a narrative, isn't there? And I expect this is probably true with both fiction and fact. So mine is the narrative of the story, and then I find there's that crunchy things, like my editor when I was first, because my skill is to, I could tell you what my book about is in 30 seconds. That's my skill. Your skill as writers is to be able to expand that into a whole book. And he would say, oh, you know that sentence you wrote about blah, could you write a chapter? And I go, no, of course I can't.
That's daunting.
And that's what I call crunchy thought. And actually, that's when, you know, you really have to kind of like put your heart on the line, don't you? And kind of get deep in your brain and actually kind of like express yourself, which is hard, but some of your best bits, isn't it?
Yeah. And like I say, as a creative outlet, it's great. And I think, you know, because it's quite a physical thing. I mean, I sometimes write notes as well. Actually seeing words on a page and stuff is, you know, and reading them back or whatever is... Yeah, there's something cathartic about that.
I do. I try to also, I just think, you know, I've learned so much along the way. And, you know, you just got to get stuff down, haven't you? Because if there's nothing on the page, then you're nowhere, are you? Do you see what I mean?
And also not beat yourself up if you've only written one sentence, because you're one sentence closer to finishing it or being...
Oh, now that's a good... So that's like that's my marathon lovely. Mantra.
Yeah, exactly.
That's my marathon mantra. Yeah. Okay, so I just think I'm just going to run to that lamppost, then I'll decide whether I'll run to the next one. Yeah.
Because it's very hard, because we were hard on, I think as creatives, you're hard on yourself. Really, and I think if you think, oh, God, I've only written one sentence, I've been staring at the screen all day or whatever, but you have written one sentence. Yeah.
I had to like move location.
Yeah. Yeah. I go to a local cafe and write in there all the time. Yeah. And but it I sounds weird because it'd be noisy and stuff, but actually I quite like that.
Yeah, my husband is, it's just really funny because I've just been down in Cornwall doing some writing, and he's like, don't write for too long, because I just get lost sometimes, and literally time, again, in a completely different way, just flies. I've got the dogs down there and they're literally nagging me, and I'm like looking down my watch and going, oh my gosh, they haven't been out for like 2.5 hours. But it's an amazing thing, and it's such a fun thing to be able to do. And I've just been chair of the Women's Prize for Fiction this year, so I've done a lot of reading, and I have absolutely fallen in love with literature again, and voices and stories, and because you just learn so much, don't you, and get transported to different places. It's been really fun.
As you alluded to earlier, obviously reading was a big part of your life when you were younger, and it's amazing actually how we come back to these things that are probably our authentic self, you know, those things that actually light us up as individuals often stem from those early pursuits, the things that we really loved as children.
I was just a bookworm. And you're right. But during breakfast, when those years, I mean, they did ask me to be judge on the Women's Prize then. And I just knew I just didn't have the brain space because I'm a kind of all in sort of person. And I knew I really wanted to sort of do it justice. So they were literally, Kate Moss with the E, the writer, was the first person to get in touch with me when I said I was leaving BBC Breakfast and say, Louise, can you be a judge?
Kate's great. I know Kate a little bit and she's really great. I'm obviously a brilliant author as well.
So I feel very lucky that you're right. I used to write stories when I was little, but they were terrible. So, you know, you need, I've needed all these years of experience to make them a bit better.
I saw a quote on Twitter or Instagram or something from Kurt Vonnegut. Was it his name right there? I think so.
Yeah.
And they might not be true, but it's like he wrote a letter to some school kids or something who had written to him. And he said, like, be creative, just do something. Like, I want you to write a poem just for you and then tear it up and put it in the bin. But like, you don't, you know, not everything has to be for something. You can just enjoy the process of writing, the joy. And I think that's really, I hope that's true. It might not be, but I think it's really lovely. Like, and find the joy in that creativity and find the joy in writing something terrible, or whatever, and just do it. And you can feel it in your heart, can't you, when you're doing that kind of stuff?
Yeah. And I think for me, I'm in that kind of strange stage now where it's so nice that you've seen the book, because it's so much in your head, isn't it? And it's so much a journey that I've been on with these amazing women. And what's going to be so exciting about, like, the launch and stuff is that they're going to meet for the first time. I feel we're all joined together, but I'm the joined. You see what I mean? They're actually going to meet each other. And then, you know, my dad's reading it at the moment and he keeps sending me little messages going, oh my gosh, I've just got out of the cave.
Oh, amazing.
I can hardly read.
Yeah. Amazing.
But it's, you know, when you're creative, it's so much in your own. My poor husband has, you know, he hasn't read it yet, but I've read a lot of it too. Bless him. But it's so much in your own space, isn't it? And then it goes on a journey and you feel nervous at the start of that journey, but also it's super exciting as well.
Yeah, I think that was just going back to what you were saying, Jim. It's something I've been thinking about recently, is the idea of just, because we're so results driven, aren't we, these days? And I think actually just enjoying the creative journey and doing stuff for yourself. And if it gets published or if people read it, then that's like a lovely bonus. But actually just creating stuff for yourself is, it should kind of always be that at the beginning.
You're really good at you're really good at lots of things. First of all, reaching out to people on Twitter and saying nice things to them, by the way.
Thank you.
And also, I think it's important in some ways. It feels strange, doesn't it? But to kind of like hold the book's hand.
Yeah.
You're really good at that. And kind of, I think that's an important moment, because I sort of think, you know, I could have just written it and walked away from it. But I think actually, if I want these stories to be told and heard, then it's incumbent on me to actually help it along its way in some ways, which feels unnatural, but
I totally
feel
get
weird
that.
Yeah, but I think it's part of the journey.
It really is
that book.
But you'll know this, I mean, so my other one, Dare to Try, people are still buying it and messaging me, and it's just, I mean, god, that is just the most rewarding thing.
It's so lovely when
isn't it, when
you think someone's actually taken that time, because, you know, reading a book's not a, it's not something, you know, it's not like listening to a song or even watching a movie. Like, it's dedicate. You have to dedicate quite a lot of time to doing that.
Yeah. And then what they've done, they've gone and done Iron Man.
Oh, amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's bonkers, isn't it? Or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, for me, you know, hopefully the message in the book, it doesn't have to be extreme, you know.
Yeah.
It's about encouraging people to go and do their own adventures. And that could be, I don't know, walking up a local hill or whatever it is. Doesn't need to be big.
No, it doesn't. Well, Louise, it's been so lovely to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Lovely, you too. And
it's been amazing.
Yeah, and the book's called, obviously the book's called Fearless, Adventures with Extraordinary Women. And it's out on the 25th of May, is that right?
It's out on the 25th of May. Not that I'm counting in any way, but it's out. And you haven't got this lovely version, which this is so many exciting things. So it's embossed.
Oh, that is exciting. Yeah, I love
I mean, it's very tactile. And it's got lots of photos.
Photos and embossed. What more could you want?
Exactly. You know, it's a good book.
We wrote a book about this podcast, and
is it?
And our lettering's embossed as well.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it?
So
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, it's quite. It is very tactile, isn't it? It's very nice.
Yeah, we're plugging our own book now.
Yeah. Sorry.
Good.
So you've got the top drawer book.
But Charles, I think you do on Twitter and stuff is I know sometimes you take breaks from it and stuff, but it's really lovely to see your messages. And sometimes when you know you reach out to people and you don't know that they're necessarily not feeling great, but you do that and it's brilliant. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Louise. That really means a lot. Thank you. Really appreciate that.
And good luck with your next thing that you're definitely not writing.
Yeah, the thing that you're not allowed to talk about
that I'm not doing.
Yeah.
I'll come and talk to you about that when the thing
When it doesn't happen.
When the thing you're not doing,
you won't come and talk to us about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Listen, I'd love to do stand up one day as well, so I'll come and watch you.
Oh, okay, yeah. Don't take notes though.
Just bring a watch.
Tell me to get off. 5 minutes, Jim.
Yeah.
Oh, you've been a star. Thank you. Really, Louise, thank you so much. Thanks for the support.
No, thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Louise mentioned on the Blank podcast, what an absolute legend. Fantastic having her on. Inspiring person as well, herself, as well as all the people in the book she spoke to as well. So absolute legend. Very excited about what she's definitely not doing next. Yeah. But yeah, we'd love to have her on again at some point. It was an absolute joy talking to her. And I love hearing all the behind the scenes TV stuff. Like I love all that stuff as well. So, fascinating about that.
Yeah, because she talked to, obviously, you know, I was intrigued about, you know, those sort of live TV shows in the mornings they must be quite like pressure cookers, I guess, aren't they?
Yeah.
With regards to like rolling news and obviously like they have pre-planned guests and all that stuff as well. And you're kind of going from one thing to the other, like in next to no time. And yeah, I can imagine, like she said, she used to feel quite exhausted afterwards, and it makes sense, really, because your brain is just like all here, there and everywhere. So that's always really interesting to hear about that stuff, because that is, to me, that would be, I think live television would probably be something I would not enjoy doing.
Done a bit of it, but it is pretty intense. But that thing about the swimming in the docks and the feeling of the water on our hands and stuff, fascinating the way that can take you back to places and takes her to that zen place. It's great. I really find that interesting, and I need to find my own zen feeling somehow, and who knows where that'll be, but I will keep you posted.
Thank you. I want to know where your happy place is. Do you remember Happy Gilmore?
Welcome. Yeah,
the movie with Adam Sandler when he's a golfer.
Great movie.
Yeah, well, so his trainer is the brilliant Carl Weathers, who plays Chubbs. He talks about him getting to his happy place, and then he sort of visualizes like his happy place, which is kind of random in the film, but you know, we've all got our own random happy places. So I think maybe you need to discover what your happy place is.
Yeah, just not environmental, or gets his arm bitten off by a crocodile.
Yeah, preferably.
But yeah, God, I don't know how to get a bit my hand
but,
off.
But cut me down in my pram. Sorry. If you haven't seen Abby Gilmore, it's one of Adam Sandler's best comedy
movies.
Where
have you been?
Yeah.
Like 30 years old.
But I'm imagining that pink rainbows would definitely be in The Happy Place.
Oh, rainbows probably would be, yeah. And probably is pink. Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
Sunshine, lollipops and rainbows.
That'll be the music.
Yeah.
Maybe it's here in this room.
Yeah.
While I work that out, well, listeners don't need to hear my whole process of that. I think we should go and have another week where we chat to another fantastic guest, which will be back next week, of course. But until then, mate, have a good week.
You too, Jim.
Thank you very much. And remember,
don't get cancelled. man.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.